Today I want to talk about mediated communication. I'll try to turn off the light here. Is that the light? Yes, should be better. So last time, what did we talk about? Oh yeah, thank you. Shared editing, which covers the one of the three circles of one of my diagrams. You remember that? Yes. And that was a circle called sharing. Yeah. Now we're going to talk about mediated communication, which is about the circle called communication. Well, we're getting somewhere. Okay, so humans like to communicate. We've invented language for that, among other things. How do you communicate these days? Well, I'm sure you communicate face-to-face. That's what we're doing at the moment. I'm sure you use physical mail. When's the last time you wrote a letter to someone?
Just a few weeks back before I applied for cash, you know.
Okay. Good. So it still exists. So people still use surface mail sometimes. Telephone, of course. When's the last time you used a real telephone? Yeah. Yeah, the one that, you know, hooked up to the wall and you have to turn. Yeah, years. But you use your smartphones as phones with various online services, of course. Email, instant messaging, texting, video conferencing. Anything else you use to communicate with people?
Smoke signals.
Hmm?
Gesture.
Well, in face-to-face communication, and that's going to be one of the points here, is that face-to-face is a very rich medium because, of course, you talk to each other, but you see the other person's facial expressions, the gaze of the person, where the other person is looking, and, of course, the gestures that accompany speech. And you can communicate with gestures only, and there are a number of gestures that are culturally significant for communication. Anything else? Any other technology you use to communicate? Yes?
In virtual reality.
Virtual reality. Okay.
Together in this avatar. The other avatar.
Okay. You do that often?
Never.
Does anybody communicate with friends in the virtual world?
VR chat is a nice application. You have an avatar. And
yeah.
You can chat with people, then usually it gets crazy because avatars can be anything, you know.
So. Okay, so you can be a dog.
Yeah, also worse stuff. So.
Okay.
Like boards in public spaces.
Boards, so yeah, shared built-in boards.
For example, like your kitchen, you have a big bulletin board.
Yes. Okay. We'll cover some of that in the next class, actually. To me, there is the face-to-face communication the mediated communication is more a person-to-person or group-to-group. And when you use shared artifact, it's like a post-it note or a bulletin board. It's a little bit different. But yes, it's in the scope of communication, indeed. I don't know who else raised their hand. Zach?
Oh, well, I was going to say like Animojis, the Apple, like...
Yeah?
It's avatar.
Okay, so it's kind of impersonating an avatar. Yes?
Audio conferencing,
yes. So here I put telephone, which is typically one-to-one, but audio conferencing can be group conferencing. Now, the thing is, the means for human communication are, very, very old. There is a fantastic book that's cited at the end by a journalist called The Information. And it starts by looking at how people have communicated at a distance, in particular over the ages. Because even if you have language, if you don't have the electronic means we have nowadays, and you want to communicate at a distance with someone, it gets complicated. So either you write the message and give it to someone who's going to run to the destination and maybe, you know, get killed or hurt on the way. And so people very early on have invented other means of communication. And one that I did not know about that I discovered in this book is that, and that's still in use today in some tribes, I would say, is using trees. So how do you communicate using trees? Well, they found out that some types of trees are resonators. And so if you bang on the tree, it makes a noise that can be heard very far away. And so then you just have to invent the code, like a Morse-like code, to communicate message by banging on trees. The other means that everybody knows from, I guess, movies, and someone mentioned, is the
smoke signals.
Which indeed was used, and in Europe before before the telephone was widespread, there was a means of communication that was installed in part of Europe to communicate messages visually. So what they would do is that at the top of hills or places that were high enough, they would bring a tower, and they would have a set of semaphore signals. And then they would put another one so that on the day where it's not foggy, you could see the first tower, and they would relay the signals visually to the destination. And then, of course, there was electrical communication with the Morse signal until we could put voice on those wires and get the telephone and all that. But what's interesting is that people have really invented all sorts of means of communication over the ages. And so we're just continuing to do this, and what we'll see is that people have appropriated existing systems for communication sometimes. And the first example is, in fact, the telephone. So 1876, Graham Bell invents the telephone, which is the idea of communicating a voice signal over an electric wire. Interestingly, very shortly after 1882, this guy Dumoncel, French guy, introduces the telephote to the French Academy of Science. And the telephote is, in fact, a fax machine. So the fax machine is almost as old as the telephone itself. It took until 1927 so that the first television transmission was pioneered in the U.S. The television, of course, was older, but finding a way to transmit an image signal over the waves took some time. Here it's the AT&T president at the time, demonstrating the first television. Now, interestingly, the telephone was not invented. The telephone was not invented for person-to-person communication. In fact, the first uses of the telephone that were anticipated was for in a department store, for the person running one of the floor in the department store or one of the departments. To be able to communicate easily with all the people on the floor, all the people doing the sales on the floor. So the telephone also was meant so people would call to get information. So it was seen as a one-to-many medium. As people started to use it from person to person, that demonstrated the value of having this kind of medium for person to person, and started to grow like this. And this is a mistake that has been done time and again. For example, the first version of text messaging, the phone companies didn't believe it was going to be useful. They figured that it's much better to be able to talk to someone than to type, you know, messages. They were very surprised that, you know, people really embraced text messaging so much, and then they made it a big business, including by charging you a price that is outrageous compared to the bandwidth that it uses. And other mistakes have been to also, well, it's a, in a sense a similar mistake if you want to look at it this way. Very early on, people wanted to go from telephone to the picture phone. It's like, well, it's so much better to hear someone than to, you know, exchange letters by mail. But it would be even so much better to see the person I'm talking to, not just hear their voice. And so there have been efforts very early on to create the picture phone. It was first presented in 1964 at the World's Fair. And people didn't like it. So survey results indicated that most people did not like picture phone. The equipment was too bulky. The controls were awkward because you needed more manipulation to turn on things, etc. And the picture was small, so it was not good enough. I believe it was 1977, in the south of France, in Biarritz. Well, Biarritz is famous now because they had one of these G7 recently, right? Nice little city in the southwest of France. They had installed fiber optics in a number of homes around the city, and they wanted to test advanced telecommunication things. And so they installed a picture phone there in those homes of normal people. And people didn't like it. It was much better quality than the stuff from 1964 and all that. But what happens when you have a picture phone is you are in your home, someone is calling. You don't know who is calling. They didn't have a call ID at the time. So you have to decide if you replied with just audio or video. But showing yourself in your home is invasive, right? Whereas just on the phone, it's less problematic. But if someone calls you, knows you have a picture phone, and you don't show your image, it means like you're hiding something. And so we get into this whole thing of plausible deniability. People have expectation that, you know, if you have a picture phone, you should show yourself. But if you don't want to show yourself, that means etc. So that's really an interesting fact, that the technology has been developed based on assumptions that are usually done by engineers, based on doing things better, faster, whatever, not necessarily taking into account the social aspect of whether people would accept this. I'm going to show a little clip here from a movie that you may have heard of, 2001, Space Odyssey. Yes? No? Okay. That's a classic of the classic, so hasn't aged well. The end part is intensely boring, and anyway. But so it's about, I won't go into what it's about. But there is a scene with a picture phone. Yeah? I don't know if you can hear, sorry. All of these are online, so yeah. So here's in the space station, and he says, well, before you go to the meeting, I want to make a call to my daughter, or my wife, or my family. So he goes into this booth, he puts his credit card, ready to place a call, he's dialing a number. We know he's in the space station because the Earth is subtly in the background there. So it's the daughter's birthday the next day, and she's asking, are you going to come to my party tomorrow? And no, daddy is traveling. I've sent you a present. I don't know how we sent a present from the space station. They didn't have Amazon at the time, so. The interesting thing is that to shoot this video, of course, the system is completely fake. I think the little girl here is the daughter of the director. And it took them forever to get her to act as if she was in the situation of a picture frame conversation with her father. And okay, have a nice birthday tomorrow. Hey, and it cost $1.70. Now, would you be willing to pay $1.70 today to talk for 2 minutes to your family?
We used to. If I have to tell my daughter I'm not coming for birthday, maybe I.
Is that possible now if you go for the first meet and then you don't have a hotel? It's the same price.
3 minutes call.
Yeah? But who uses the telephone anymore?
Sometimes.
Okay. And you don't use like Skype audio or stuff
if
like that?
If you are on 3G, 4G is still bad.
Okay. 4G? Come on. I do FaceTime on 4G with my son in the US all the time. Anyway, my point is that one thing that has changed is communication used to be expensive. Even plain phone line in your home used to be expensive. Long-distance calls used to be super expensive. When cell phones arrived, it was super expensive. And now we have these unlimited plans. And not only that, but if you don't use a phone carrier, you can communicate with Skype or other services for free, literally on the internet. And that knowing that communication and video communication in particular is one of the main traffic on the internet. Anyway, what I wanted to show here is that this idea that people want to communicate is very strong. And so when we go from people's personal lives, like this was sort of an illustration, to the workplace, there has been a lot of effort to try to save money by getting video conferencing systems in place instead of flying people back and forth all the time, right? And so nowadays, people are even encouraged to do teleworking by staying home so they don't have to commute to work back and forth. So you save the time, you save the expense, you save the CO2, et cetera, et cetera. So starting in the 90s, there was a lot of hope around these video conferencing systems. And a number of companies were, and still market, these very expensive video conferencing rooms. And so what they do is they install a system sort of like that, with here three screens, videos, loudspeakers, a nice table with nice chairs in front of it. They usually paint and do the lighting in the room so it looks reasonable, because as soon as you shoot something with video cameras, it looks like crap. And we are used to seeing video images on TV or in movies that have been, in fact, fabricated in the sense that there is lighting equipment, there is color correction done for movies. So to make things look natural on TV or in film, takes a lot of artificial effort. And so if you do this video conferencing room by just sticking two cameras in a poorly lit room like this one where the light is coming from the top, you're going to look like vampires. And so it's not good for doing business. So typically one of these rooms would go for $1 million. And because they're expensive, they were used only by the high management, the CEO. And so typically what they do is they put the important people in the middle of the room and then the other ones on the side. But typically they're going to have one camera, and so that completely skews the cues we have when we are face-to-face. Now, there's something in video conferencing that is called the Mona Lisa effect. You know Mona Lisa? Yeah, you've seen it?
Yeah.
Yeah? Wow, lucky you. So the Mona Lisa effect, Mona Lisa is the painting in the Louvre, okay? The Mona Lisa effect is the notion that wherever you are watching at the picture, it looks like she's looking at you. Which is the same thing you have when you're watching a newscast on TV. The TV presenter is looking at the camera, and therefore the image on your screen is flat because he's looking towards the camera. Wherever you are, you feel like he's looking at you. Had you ever noticed that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the thing is that when you are around the table for a physical meeting, people are very aware of who is looking at whom because not only I can detect eye contact if I look at one of you in the eyes, you immediately like, ooh. but you can also tell whom I'm looking at if I'm not looking at you, right? So this is called gaze awareness. And we use that constantly, and it regulates the flow of turn-taking. Because people can anticipate when someone's want to talk, or if two people are speaking to each other. Now, when you go to a video conferencing system, if there is only one camera here in the middle, everybody on the other side is going to misinterpret, in a sense, what the others are looking at. In fact, for establishing eye contact over a video link, what you would have to have is to have the camera literally behind the screen, right? Which, of course, you can do. So here, they typically put the camera either below or over, and both are problematic. Because if the camera is above the screen, I'm going to look at people's faces. So I'm looking below the camera, and so they're seeing me looking downwards towards a part of their body that you're not supposed to look at. And if you do the other way around, you put the camera below the screen, and the problem is, of course, all the much worse if you have bigger screens, and people like having big screens. So if you put the camera below, I'm still looking at people's face. Now I'm being shot from underneath, so it looks I'm looking above your head, which is not also very socially acceptable. So people have tried to compensate for that. There's a way to actually fake this notion of the gaze awareness and eye contact, which I'll talk about in a second. The result of that is there was great disappointment around this technology. People were frustrated. First of all, it was complex to operate. You needed to have a technician every time to get things going. And you know, to this day, yesterday we were having a PhD defense in our group. One of the members of the committee couldn't make it, so she was connecting remotely. It always takes half an hour to get things hooked up and all that. So it's not the same thing as, oh, you know, let's have a meeting, we go into a meeting room, and then we can start. So many technical problems. Sound is always tricky because you have feedback effects, which annoys everyone, and we don't have eye contact. So can we solve this? Well, so one way to solve the eye contact thing, which is probably the most prominent problem, is to put literally the camera behind the screen. But of course, your display is not transparent, so we have to fake it. One way to fake it is if the screen is here, you put in front of it a half-silvered mirror. That means that half of the light is going through the mirror and the other half is being reflected, right? So it's semi-transparent. And then you put the camera either above, or you put another real mirror here, and you put the camera literally above, so it will have this optical path, which means that me, the viewer, looking into the screen at where the face of my of the other participant is, the camera is shooting me as if it were in front of me. And so I can have eye contact through this, what they call video tunnel. But that's not enough. Because when we are in a meeting, each person has a different point of view on the room. I see the room from where I am, you see it from where you are, and it's different. The other thing is that we move our head all the time, and our cues for depth perception and things like this, especially if you have like a group of people, or is not based on stereoscopic vision, as I mentioned in the intro class, but it's based on your movement. So what we want really is for each person on one side of the video conferencing session to have a camera in the other room that represents his head and eyes. So it should be able, there should be one per remote participant, and they should also be able to move like I can move my head, right? So turns out Bill Gaver and colleagues who were working together with these people, Bill Buxton, Tom Moran, that was all done in the early 90s at Xerox PARC and Xerox EuroPARC in particular. So Bill Gaver did this thing where he put a window, a camera, sorry, he created the video window, so he put the camera on a device where he could control both the position and orientation. And he was coupling that with the motion of the head, and so he called it the video window because it's the effect they have when you look through a window, and if there's something you want to look at on the left, you move to the right, and you see further. And so he had this device, unfortunately I don't have video of it, was making very weird noise, but it was giving really a sense of being there, because as you move your head, you could really explore the remote space. Whereas, I mean, I'm sure you've all done, video conferencing or video chats. It's the other party that controls what the camera is looking at. It's not you. So that's one aspect of it, which could be done today with much simpler technology. The other thing that was tested was this idea of having multiple views. And that's the Hydra system, also done in that context. Abby Salin was a student of Bill Buxton. And we're going to see a little video. This is Buxton.
This is one of the three working prototypes that we built. It consists of a color LCD monitor, a camera, and a loudspeaker, and comes in a very compact package. It tilts forward and backwards, and has a telescopic feature, which enables you to adjust the viewing position and the camera angle. Let's see it in action.
Well, we have our all three prototypes on my desk now, and I'm having a round-the-table conversation with three colleagues. On my left is Tracy. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Bill.
And the center is Abby. She's sitting right across the table from me.
Hi, Bill.
And over to the right is my daughter, Katie, who's joined us to see what we're doing. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Now, to preserve the notion of around the table, Katie sees Tracy across from her, and Abby sees me across from her. Now, Abby, where is Tracy?
Tracy's over there.
Okay, and Katie?
Katie's over there.
Okay, and where's Abby for you?
She's over here.
Great. Now you'll notice that the space occupied by each remote participant is very small, and yet they have the distinct location, which means that the sound comes from their own personal space. But furthermore, each person can see where each other person is directing their attention or their gaze. Eye contact can be maintained because of the small angle between the camera and the monitor. And there's enough space on the desk for me to do other work. Therefore, through the use of industrial design, we're able to give an implementation of the concept which is actually testable and usable in a real-world
real-world context. which they never did. But that's life in research. You will say, oh, we'll do the studies. That's the future work, a part of the paper. And then sometimes it happens, but more often it doesn't. Okay, so what do you get out of this?
see your release already made. So.
Well, so this was done in 1992. You know, the technology is probably not what we would be doing today. The screens, I agree, are very small. But there was also, it's interesting if you look at the whole video, because they explain all the design process. They work with a design firm in Toronto to create this thing. Nowadays, with Fab Labs, you know, you could do this at home. At the time, they had to contract a design firm that had the equipment to build these things. In the video, you show their first prototype where they, you know, duct tape a camera to a small TV screen and the loudspeaker to have this horrible contraption so they could test the concept. I think here what they wanted to do was to go to a system that could be installed for real in real people's office, that doesn't take too much space, that can be adjusted, etc. I agree the screen is small, but I think this idea of embodying each participant with their own image, point of view, a microphone, and loudspeaker. I don't know if you've ever been on a multi-party audio conference. But it's super hard to say who is speaking. You have to recognize the voices because you don't have the spatial cue. Whereas in a room, you know where the sound is coming from, so you know who's speaking.
Yeah, I feel like the small screens aren't a problem because ultimately it's more about where people are when you're talking to them than, I mean, you want to see facial expressions and gestures a little
yeah.
bit, but like, you just need to know where they're looking, kind of, whether they're like happy or mad, basically. Like,
yeah, no, but it can be sufficient to get...
So
much better than Skype already.
It's not really a problem, but you don't even see the eyes of people, so you don't see if they're really looking at you. I mean,
well, the video is crappy. The screens. I mean, if you put a smartphone, you know, a smartphone is very high resolution. So, I know. Do you video chat on your smartphones?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, not bad. Better than nothing. But I think what's interesting here is the way they studied the importance of these spatial cues and people turning towards each other so you know physically where people are. And I've done a lot of things over video conferencing where you have this mosaic of people there. And it's, well, first I find it very tiring compared to a physical meeting because you have to really figure out who is speaking and... turn-taking is also less natural because you don't have this social, this hints in people's body language that they want to speak or that they are talking to that person as opposed to that person. So the era of the large, of the expensive, at least, video conferencing rooms, sort of a... didn't really work out in the market as much as they were expecting. Every company still has these rooms. It's also a question of social status, you know, in a sense. But the next step was to move from company-wide video conferencing rooms to desktop video conferencing, so having these capabilities on your desktop. And of course, when people put things on the desktop, they start thinking of it as it's a new application. And if it's a new application, it has to have a bunch of features and a bunch of buttons. So this is the software called ShareVision from 1997. Is that a cool design or what? I don't know. There's more buttons there than on a 747 airplane. I like the fact that they still have the telephone dial here with 1, 2, 3 and the letters. So this thing has video here, has a shared drawing thing. Here you have a directory so you can send messages and call people. And here another thing, I don't know what it is. Over time, people realize that, you know, people want to communicate. They don't want to have to fight a complex application. So things have become simplified. This was Microsoft NetMeeting in 2002. Here they stuck with the telephone analogy, so you have to punch in a number. I don't know why it took so much time to get rid of phone numbers and use, you know, meaningful names. And this is Apple iChat in 2004, which, as you can see, has a much simpler interface and supports multi-party. And what I find interesting in this work, and I don't know what the influence of the Hydras was, but they've made this layout, sort of fake 3D layout, of the three people you're talking to, so you get a sense. And as far as I recall, it was done consistently across the four people talking here, so the relative positions are the same. Now, you still have a single camera, so you don't have all the features of the iChat where each person would see the other parties from different angles, but you still get this sense that you are in the space. How often do you use multi-party video conferencing? Or video? How often do you use multi-party, so more than one person to one person?
When I was working every day.
When it was working every day?
A meeting every day with customers or...
So in the business environment?
Exactly.
Okay.
So Hangouts usually or Skype, depending on...
Okay. And now, when you do this, how long do you run these things?
1 hour.
Okay. So... this is still the idea that we have a meeting, and here's a video meeting instead of a regular meeting, right? Oh, yeah. So the question then is, why were this system, what types of tasks were these systems designed for? Most of the systems were created based on the telephone model that... you want to talk to someone, you pick up the phone, you dial a number, the person hopefully answers, then you talk, and then at some point you're done, and you say bye, and you hang up, right? The thing is that face-to-face conversation is rarely like that. So, you seem surprised. Well, the thing is that we have all this... social protocols that we're so used to, we don't even take notice. But before, so for example, imagine I'm in my office at work and my door is open, because if I'm in my office and my door is open, it means I'm not super busy. There's a very big difference to me if the phone rings because someone is calling me and I feel compelled to answer the phone, rather than someone goes by my office, peeks an eye through it, see if I'm busy or not, and based on that, decides, depending on how much they know me, maybe someone will knock, maybe someone will just say hi, maybe someone will say, oh, I need to speak to you. So we have all this protocol to decide if we engage in conversation or not. And there are studies in sociology that have looked at that. So you take two people at two ends of a corridor, you know, walking towards each other. So this whole approach is augmented by all these cues that we give to the other. We may speed up a little bit to show we're busy, I don't want to talk to you, I don't have time. Or you may slow down and hope that a person will stop and you'll spend half an hour, chatting in the corridor. And all of that is done in a sort of natural way. We don't even think about it. And we've learned to recognize, or most people have learned to recognize those signs, right? When you use these systems, none of this is like this. You know, your phone rings and you need to hang up, and sometimes and more people are hiding their phone number or identity, so you don't know who's calling. When you do a meeting, you book the room with a video conference from 1 hour to you have to anticipate how long the meeting is going to take, and someone else has booked it after you, so you're going to be kicked out. So it changes the nature of communication. So and the other thing is they tend to focus on communication only, when most of the time, not all of the time, sometimes we just need to chat and that's fine, but especially in business environment, when we communicate with people, you also need to share artifacts, a presentation or a design or something that needs to be discussed or etc. So the question is, are we really focusing on supporting communication, or are we trying to support the notion of a shared environment and a shared presence in this environment where we can communicate, we can also share objects and talk about them, etc. And I think that gets me back to Doug Engelbart, who already understood this before anyone else, and his system that he built in the 1960s. So here is, I've shown this video again in the intro class, but I'll show it again.
So I'm going to establish a collaborative mode between me.
So he has a hypertext system.
So when we come in through this intercom,
hello, Doug.
That is shareable, so it's a shared editing, shared screen conference with telepointers. They have an audio link.
Well, he's looking at my text. He might have something to say about it. So we put on a marker, a tracking spot that he controls. So he's sitting in the middle box looking at this text, and he can point to it. Well, we carefully reserved for me the right to control and operate on this, so my bug is more powerful than yours. But we can have an argument. Yeah. That's like all about fight. Computer to the automatic switching that will bring in a camera picture from the camera mounted on his console, such as the camera mounted on mine. Hi, Bill. That's great. Now we're connected. Audio, you can see my work, you can point at it, and I can see your face, and we can talk. So let's do some collaborating.
So they have a shared document, they have an audio link, and they have a video link, and all of this is integrated. And nowadays, if you want to do the same thing, well, you have to go to Google Doc and you create a shared document and you send a link to the other person, and then you need to know their Skype ID or Hangout something so you can connect to them with another system, whether it's Skype or something else, and then you can start collaborating. And we've done a study recently of video communication, especially over Skype. 70% of the calls have problems. So I think the fact that all these tools have been separated from each other and lost track of why do people use these tools is really a bad thing. And I think there is a lot of room to invent more modern but better tools adapted to what people actually do. And the thing is, a lot of this research work has already been done. So once again at Xerox PARC in the early 90s, people have looked at how to combine the communication space with the action space, where people communicate and share documents. So John Tang and Scott Miniman created VideoDraw, which is this system where people can draw together on the same surface, virtual surface, even though they are away from each other. And there's a camera above here, so you're not sharing just the drawing, which you can do with a shared drawing tool, but you see the hand of the other person. And that's very important, because when you communicate, assuming the two people can speak to each other, if you want to show something, you're going to gesture. So being able to see at least the hands is very useful. So here's a short video from that system. So TV so he can see the other, the shared surface, camera above shooting his hand, and he's drawing on another TV screen that shows the image captured by the other camera. Okay, we're going to see it more concretely. So here they're going to play tic-tac-toe. So he's drawing the grid. He's starting in the middle, of course. This is the other person's hands that showed up. Then he pulls his hand out. Then the first one plays. Here's the other one. So you really have the sense that you are sharing that space.
So it's like projected from the top?
No, it's captured from the top, but displayed on the bottom. Yeah, and so they use normal pens, so the camera captures your hand and your writing. So it's not it's a
no
proof of concept.
Okay.
There is no software. And so that's to illustrate that, you know, you have really the notion that you, so you see the third hand here, we can write. So they're really sharing this drawing, and they can discuss it and collaborate. You have people will spontaneously avoid, you know, scribbling over the other person, etc. So you have all these social protocols that come into play. This technique was pushed further by researchers, now famous, Hiroshi Ishii, who was at the time at the NTT Labs in Japan. NTT is a national telephone company in Japan. And he was working also on combining drawing tools with video communication. So one of his first system called Teamwork Station here showed an image of the shared drawing that you can see here, the video images of the two people, or the other parties, sorry, in the corners. And same idea, there is a camera above that captures what you're drawing, and then the two images are merged on the screen in front. And the next step was to go from hands to full body. So the same authors, Tang and Minman, a year later, they went from video draw to video whiteboard. And it's a little bit of the same idea, but it's done on the large projection screen. And what the camera is capturing, since the camera is behind the screen, it's only showing the shadow of the person. I think the video will better explain what's going on. So you see the shadow of the person in the back, as if he were just behind the screen, when in fact is in, well, the next room in that case. But that's sufficient to give you an idea of what he's doing, of where he's drawing. He can show things. And I think an advantage also over having the full image is that he can step back and know that he's not visible, so he's not creating confusion with what's on the drawing. So here they're drawing the diagram of how the system works. No, no, this was done in a lab. They were in two separate rooms in the same lab, and there were wires on the floor.
Can you imagine that sending, like, because everything, all of this is before the internet became big, so they...
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing. When you are in research, you make assumptions about what the technology can be 5, 10, 15 years further to make something that is a prototype into a working system. We'll talk in a moment about media spaces. For years, we did media spaces by running cables for audio and for video along the corridors in the buildings, knowing that one day this will be digitized. But we wanted to anticipate what systems, what technology, what services we would build before the technology could afford it. So we would be ready when the technology is there. And I think a problem that we have in research nowadays is people want to do innovative stuff, but then runs on today's hardware. And I think that's a mistake. When I was when I started as a PhD student, the thing is you were trying to get the most powerful computer possible, knowing that because of the cost of computation going down, 5 or 10 years later, it would be in everybody's hands. And now I see a lot of papers in conferences that get criticized because, oh, you know, it doesn't work on my laptop. I'm not interested if it works on your laptop. I'm interested if it's going to work on everybody's laptops 10 years from now. And that's my talk I've given before, where, you know, it does take time for inventions to become innovations.
So early in the lecture, you showed videos of them making video calls already in the 80s, so they were able to send the video signal
Yeah, but that was not over the internet. That was over... either over the air, like old TV, not the digital TV of today, or like the telephone was sending, you know, electric signals, but not digital ones for many, many years before it became digital. So this would work if you were willing to run enough cables to carry the signals. And then the following year, we're back to Hiroshi Ishii at NTT, created the ClearBoard, which takes this idea of overlaying the image of the participant, of the remote participant, with the shared document here. The idea being that you want to recreate the eye contact capability as well as the gaze awareness, figuring out where the other person is looking. So,
such as the partner's gestures, head movements.
I hate the voice in this video.
In order to solve these problems, I think we came up with the new metaphor of talking.
Yeah, sorry, I can't take it. So they first prototyped this with just a glass. And people just writing or drawing, actually, because, of course, if you write, the other side is not going to be able to read it. But the idea, you know, does it make sense to really have the person behind the shared space? Not just the shadow like we saw in video whiteboard, but the real person. They wanted to see also if it was important for people to have this eye contact, which, of course, they can have through the glass, and the gaze awareness, which is looking at where the other person is looking so he can draw your attention to it. So then they created a functional prototype, ClearBoard 1, that, again, was using markers on the mirror surface, and the camera was, in fact, filming the reflection of the person's image. And so it's very faint on this image, but because you see both the reflection of his arm here, but you could see the image of the other person projected onto this. Now, this is not a digital surface. You know, you have to erase, and it's a whiteboard. But it shows that with this camera above and the silver mirror here, you can capture the face of the person, and then you can back project it on the other side, so you see the person on the other side. Now, in the process of this, you can switch the image so the writing thing gets solved. So it's going to go into details of how this all works. I hope it's not taking... Oh, and I can't control the thing here. Oh, no, that's it. I cut it into two clips. So, and then they built ClearBoard 2, which is a fully digital prototype using the same approach, having the camera above filming a reflection. But instead of having this half-circle mirror, they have a surface where, through an LCD layer, they can turn it either transparent or opaque. So it's either reflecting the image or showing what's being back projected. So, point is, and plus, it's a touch-sensitive surface because now they're not drawing with markers but with an electronic pen. So it's very complex technology. But what you get is really that you see the other person on the other side. They are drawing on an electronic document this time, not with physical markers. And they maintain this notion of eye gaze. I can look at you in the eye, and I can see where you are looking. And they conducted the experiments to measure how often people look at each other, look at the place where the other is working, or the place that the other person is talking about, to measure, in a sense, and emphasize the importance of having this gaze awareness and eye contact in this type of situations where you are both sharing document and discussing them. Now, the limitation of this technology is that it's limited to two people. Because if you want to put a third person, where are you going to put it? If you overlay it, the people are going to be on top of each other, so it's going to be strange. If you put them side by side, you would need something like a drawing board or a wall rather than a table like it's here. So it's really limited to one-to-one. But I still think this is an amazing, an amazing piece of technology and a very compelling prototype, as it does support very strongly coupled collaboration. So here's the technology for ClearBoard. So as I said, there's a camera filming by reflection the image of the person. There is a half mirror, half silvered mirror that is both reflecting and transparent. There's a polarizing film, a projection screen because the image is projected from the below. And there is a digitizer layer, so it can take input from the digital pen. Then all these messages are, well, or things are exchanged. The Macintosh here is managing the software that you saw on the screen for drawing. And then they do the multiplexing of the video signal. So complex technology, but for compelling result. Now, other examples of things that have been done in that space is Hypermirror from Morikawa, 98. And here the idea is, so we saw this thing where you see the image of the other person. But what it creates is a space where the other person is behind the screen, you are in front of the screen. So you're not really sharing the space. So the idea that they had here was to, as we see on this image, maybe better. So there's a projector projecting an image that overlays the remote image of the other person that we sort of see here and the image filmed by a camera that is near the screen, I think it's here, of that person. And they are merged together. And so here is another view where this is the remote person on the left. This is the, so the person in the physical space is here, and she sees her image in on the screen mixed with the remote person, and they can almost shake hands. So I have a short clip here. And the thing is that it's a very natural interaction because when you see yourself, it's easy to adjust your gestures so you actually show something, etc. Now, this is a very short clip, and I have a link to the video. When my kids were young and they were playing video games, there's this thing that came out from Sony. It was called the Sony iToy. It was, I think, it was the first game that was using a camera. And so the camera was shooting the player and showing the image of the player as sort of the background of the game. And they had all sorts of games where you were supposed to wipe windows and get rid of things. But one of the interactions that was very compelling is that when you wanted to do the setups on the game, instead of going into menus with the controller, it was done purely with gestures. And they would display buttons or settings on the screen, and you just had to put your hands on top of it and move it. And the system had a very simple motion detection algorithm. It didn't do any, you know, Kinect stuff. That was, I'm talking something in probably 98. iToy. I like the iToy. Yeah. Okay. My kids were having a great time because that was the first generation of games that we call now exergames, games that forces the player to have physical activity. Instead of just, you know, pushing buttons on the game controller. But I really like this this interaction, first because it was very technically easy to detect and very easy for the user because you see yourself, so you put your hands on top of the button, you don't even think twice about it. And here they're taking advantage of the same approach. And one of the lessons of all that is that video communication is very powerful. You know, in the previous case, even though people know they're at a distance, they feel close because they are in the same picture and they see themselves in the picture with the other person, so there's a sense of closeness. In 1980, so way before then, there were two artists, Kid Galloway and Sherry, I think, Rabinovich, created this event during 3 days between the Lincoln Center in New York, in the center of New York, and Century City, which is a shopping area, in Los Angeles. So what they did is they rented a link on a satellite, because at the time there was no internet that could carry this type of signals. And so they had put in in the storefronts of two stores a large display projecting an image captured at the other site and relayed through the satellite. But there was no explanation. It was just, you're walking in the street and there are stores and you see a window front and there's this image there. No explanation whatsoever what it was. And the funny thing is, people immediately realize that this is a communication device. It's not a recorded video or anything. There was, of course, an audio link as well. So people started asking, so who are you, where you are? And people are answering. It's like, oh. Interestingly, it was New York, Los Angeles, so 3 hours time difference. So it was, depending on the time of day, but it could be dark in one side and still light on the other. So people are like, oh, you're speaking English like me, but how come it's night on your side? But in the 3 days of the experiment, or the event, or the installation, people, word of mouth spread out, and people sort of called their relatives on the other side on the phone and said, well, let's meet at this thing next morning at 10. And so there's several clips of this that you can find online. This is a short one. Or is it? No? Ah. That's annoying. Okay. What happened there? It's a movie. Is it playing? Yes. It played, but it doesn't want to play. Okay. That's sad because I really like this video. Don't make fun of my desktop. Am I going here? Exactly. Thank you. Videos. It must be in groupware. Oh, now it's playing. Really? Okay. Well, if you... No. I love technology. Well, this way. Do you see it here? Yes. A little bit small. Or maybe it's just the title is forever. Yeah. Oh, and I had the sound off. Yes. They look like young people. Chorus line. And that's a key thing, is that the screen was big enough that people appeared at real human size. So you feel really connected because it's not like, tiny people on a small screen. And this one is starting to, date the girl on the other side. And anyway, it's... Anyway, I'll let you watch the whole thing. It's entertaining, but I think it's really a good. How do I play this thing? Where's my cursor? Yes, it's really a good example of the power of video communication if you design the system by taking into account the types of cues that we're used to. And so there was this movement going from supporting this type of planned communication, having to book a video conferencing room, or having to dial a number and not knowing if you are interrupting the person, etc., to informal communication and supporting more unplanned, spontaneous, and what is called sometimes serendipitous type of communication. Because in many situations where you have this type of formal meetings, the important stuff is in fact happening in this type of meetings that are happening, you know, during the breaks or etc. So if you support one but not the other, you're really missing a lot of interesting opportunities for communication. And so that leads me to the notion of media space. So the notion of media space was invented by Stelz and Harrison. Harrison is, in fact, an architect by training who was working at Xerox, once again, Xerox PARC. And so what they did is they wanted to test the value of supporting this type of informal communication. So they split their group in half, the research group in half. They sent one half to Portland, Oregon. They were in Palo Alto, California. So Xerox has a facility in Portland, and so they decided to have half of the group work in Portland for a while, and they hooked up the two spaces with a cross audio-video link. So there was a big display, well, big at the time, in each of the two shared common spaces in the two labs, and it was on all the time, and that's the critical thing. You didn't have to turn it on or off or dial something. It was a permanent link between those two spaces. And so, and they observed themselves how they would work in that configuration where some people are co-located with you and some are at a distance. And what they found is that sometimes someone would be sitting on one side on the couch, seeing, not watching, but seeing the space on the other side, and on the other side someone would come by, say, oh, have you seen that person? And it was the person at the remote side that said, oh, yes, she went by 5 minutes ago. She was going this direction. So there was, they call this a media space, and I think it's interesting that one of them is an architect, because he was creating this notion of we live in the same space somehow, which is an interesting experience. In fact, shortly, well, no, it was 85, but in 1992-93, in the winter of 1992-93, I went on sabbatical to the University of Toronto and to Xerox PARC when they were really working on these media spaces, and the sense that you can be in your office, but sharing an office with someone virtually where you have a similar kind of awareness of what the other person is doing or chatting or things like this as if the person were in the same office was very strong. And in fact, when I came back to France, I had been promoted to professor and I was given a single office. And I remember coming back to this office and sitting there and feeling super alone because I'd spend more than 6 months always in these systems where I was connected with someone through this video and audio link. And we've done studies recently, or not so recently, of people now that you know digital calls, digital video over Skype calls or Hangouts or these things are free. We found a lot of people. We did a study of couples who live remotely, and a lot of them use Skype that they leave on for hours and hours at home to share their everyday life. And it's a different, of course, type of use and type of experience than the very telephone-like use that, that we tend to associate with things like Skype. And at the Bell Core, which was one of the Bell laboratories, Bob Fish created this video window. He wanted to recreate the informal gathering that happens often either before or after a formal meeting to let people talk to each other. So he created this, this video window where it was a screen showing a remote space and microphones, etc. And so what they found, and they did a lot of analysis of many, many hours of video, is that it's not the same. And we have to be aware that we're not going to be able to reproduce. You can use avatars, you can use 3D models and mapping video onto 3D models of people. It's not going to be the same as being in the same space. And indeed, they realized that people have fewer conversations than in a physical meeting. It was harder to reciprocate. It was hard to have side conversations, which people do all the time in this type of setting, and there was poor eye contact. Having said that, I think there is value in creating systems for primarily for the workplace, but also for the home, and that will be the part of the talk after the break, for creating systems that better support the sense of working together, being together, and of awareness. And so in the 90s, there were a number of systems at Bellcor, at Xerox, at University of Toronto, at Digital Equipment, at Sun, and several universities created these experimental media spaces. It started typically with analog technology. I remember at, well, there's a picture actually coming up, I think, running a lot of wires to connect TVs and cameras and mics and headphones and things for these things to just work. And what we were doing, we were exploring a number of services. Because having a constant link between, say, two offices or two shared spaces is one thing. But are we going to stop there? Can we imagine other ways for people to communicate over this new media than just being always connected or nothing? And so we created services like, well, Mirror, so you could see yourself and know the picture you were sending. Glance, which is a very short two-way video-only connection. The idea is I'm going by your office and I peek if you're there or not. I don't need to hear, we don't need to talk. I just want to see if you're there. I want you to see that I'm looking for you, maybe. Video phone, which was really the equivalent of a telephone call. The office share, which was this long connection, fixed connection between two offices. And awareness view, which was a view where you say, well, I want to have a mosaic of different people or different spaces to get awareness of what they're doing. And so then the question is, once you go from a fixed setting to a set of features and services, well, you need a user interface for it. And that's where things become complicated, because in real life, we don't need this user interface. The user interface is our social skills in negotiating if we want to communicate and how we communicate. So different experiments were made. CaveCat had this matrix where you could connect everybody to everybody, but that felt like, you know, being the switchboard person at the early telephone systems. In the Rave system, we created these buttons for these typical services, but you also needed to select in the list who you want to video phone to or who you want to office share, and then is the person agreeing to do the same? So it's not just buttons, it's a bit more of a protocol to for people to negotiate this. This is the interface actually I created for the Casmer media space that ended up running for several years at Xerox and connecting up to 50 offices. And we were doing services like the window. Bill Buxton had the best office and the best view, so he had a camera shooting at this window so that everybody in the lab could have on his video screen an image of of what Bill could see through his window, because in the US, unlike at least in France and I think in most of Europe, it is absolutely legal to have offices without any window. And a lot of people are spending their working lives in windowless offices. And I remember when he came to the secretary's office, which was a windowless office, and he said, "Oh, Beverly, do you want to have a window in your office?" And she looked at him like, "Are you kidding me?" And that's how he got her to have a video screen, which was permanently linked to the camera shooting out his office's window. And then once she had this virtual window in her office for a couple of weeks, she said, "Oh, but I see that you guys use also that to talk to each other." And that's how he got the secretaries to accept to have this equipment in their offices and use it for their day-to-day communication. Because, you know, people are also suspicious of this kind of technology. And if you say to the secretary, "Oh, I'm going to put this camera in your office and anybody can look at you at any time," you know, not very acceptable. And so in the context of this telepresence project, that's where the Hydra project that I showed before was developed, and a lot of work was done. As I said, the technology was was messy. This was the main switching room in the telepresence project. Essentially, every device in every office that was connected ended up in there, plugged in onto switches, and we had software control to connect things to each other. And this sign here says, "Do not touch any of these wires." So to summarize, MediaSpaces support several levels of engagement. You can have a background view of a shared space or of the window, as I was saying. You can have a more focused call for a short time, like a video phone or video conference. You can have a very short, even shorter call to see if you can interrupt the person through a glance. Typically, people would glance first, and then if you see the other person is not too busy, you would call him or her. Or spontaneously, the other person would call you back because she could see you were looking for her. Of course, there are issues of how you control privacy. How do you say, so I didn't show in my interface, but I have the door that you can close or open partially or fully open. That changes how people have access to you, and you're publishing your accessibility in a sense. You can lock the door if you don't want to be disturbed. You can leave it wide open if anybody can glance. But there were problems if a new person arrives. How do you specify access rights on an individual basis that hasn't been solved properly? One of the rules that we found was important was the role of symmetry. If I can see you, you can see me. That's why all the video calls were two-way. And also having physical control over the devices. So all the cameras had a cap. So instead of telling the system that I don't want people to access my camera, you know, you would put the cap on the camera, like a lot of people do on their laptops these days. And there was a big red button for sound for the same reason. I think that's, so yeah, this is the interface I created. So essentially the services were here, and you could define your accessibility with this door setting. In fact, in Bill Buxton's office, he had mounted a device on his door so that his physical door state was reflected in his virtual door state. So that's the one here. And I think, what haven't I said here? I think I'm going to go directly to the failures of MediaSpaces, because the thing is that we did all this work, and you know Wendy worked in that space as well, and it was a cool time where we could experiment with technology, and we thought we could change the world, right? And the thing that is sad today is that all this work is forgotten, and now for people video mediated communication is, you know, something like that. Well, not as ugly, but it's reduced to Skype or Hangout or some other of these services that only allow you a very small range of types of communication. Also, video is not integrated with the rest of the tools, so you have to run the video thing on the side. One thing that I think is often underestimated is that in all these systems, originally for technical reason, because all the video and audio was analog, it was on a separate device. So you had your computer screen, and you had the video screen on the side. And it was a good thing to have these two spaces, if only because when someone glanced at you, it could see if you were looking at your screen or looking at the media space. But nowadays, at the same time, we're running everything on the same computer, but it's also in different apps, and I have to hook up with Skype and share a document with Google Doc and then use another thing for chat maybe, etc. And that's very heavy overhead.
Isn't it coming back a bit with like the Facebook photo thing?
Yes. Yeah.
Like
well, the only thing is that it's Facebook, so that's the part that scares me.
But you haven't talked about video streaks, which is trying to break all
well,
the
rules. No, no, I haven't. I think, well, so the reason why Facebook is doing this is an interesting question in itself. But I think, and I've been waiting for a long time to have, yeah, devices devoted to personal communication. And in the work we did, which I'll talk about after the break on interliving, this is the kind of things we built. And so, you know, this stuff was done in the 90s. We're in 2018, so we're getting onto 25, 30 years. So maybe it's time for the things to get finally out of the lab. Okay, I'm going to stop here unless there are other questions. So we're going to take a break, 15 minutes, and then I'll talk about the projects that we ran together on this stuff called interliving. Okay? Thank you. Thank you.